Good afternoon, everybody. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to the Vox Pop for this Tuesday, February 7th. I'm Alan Chartok. Earlier this month, President Trump nominated Neil Gorsuch to fill the Supreme Court seat held by the late Justice Antonin Scalia. The 49-year-old Gorsuch is a judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 10th Circuit based in Denver. Here to discuss the pick and overall Supreme Court is Albany law professor and WAMC commentator Steve Gottlieb. Want to hear from you. 1-800-348-2551. You heard me. 1-800-348-2551. It's going to be a popular show. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Your calls and emails all coming up right after this news. Hello, everybody. It's the Vox Pop. Welcome back. It's the Daily Afternoon Call-In Talk Show, and I'm Alan. Earlier this month, President Trump nominated Neil Gorsuch to fill the Supreme Court seat held by the late Justice Antonin Scalia in 2006. Judge Gorsuch was nominated by President George W. Bush, confirmed by the Senate to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 10th Circuit based in Denver. Gorsuch studied at Columbia, Harvard, and Oxford. Doesn't get better. The Supreme Court is currently split ideologically.
Excuse me?
Of course it gets
better.
I'll introduce you in a minute. The Supreme Court is currently split ideologically 4-4. President Obama's nominee Merrick Garland was refused the Senate hearing for about a year following Scalia's death. So will Gorsuch get in? What will that mean for the Supreme Court? In the studio for the discussion, you just heard him, is our wonderful commentator, Steve Gottlieb. He's Jay and Ruth Kaplan Distinguished Professor of Law at Albany Law School and author of Unfit for Democracy, The Roberts Court, and The Breakdown of American Politics. He served on the board of the New York Civil Liberties Union and is in the U.S. Peace Corps in Iran. Steve, welcome to the Vox Pop.
Thank you, Alan, and congratulations to all of us. That's a wonderful accomplishment.
Exactly, well said.
I've always wondered how you guys deal with the uncertainty of when these things will end.
Life is a crapshoot. Steve, let's talk a little bit, if we can, Professor, about the court as it now stands. We know it's 4-4. If, for example, the ban question gets up to the Supreme Court, you could pretty well expect you're going to get a 4-4 split, right?
Right.
And that 4-4 split will mean that whoever the latest lower court to have ruled on it, which would be the...
The Ninth Circuit.
Will it go directly from the Ninth Circuit to the Supreme Court?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, let me put a little caveat in there. I believe that the case in the Ninth Circuit, which is being decided or is subject to decision right now, is before a panel. The courts of appeals, the federal courts of appeals, operate mostly as three-judge panels.
Uh-huh.
And if one of the parties objects to what that panel does, they can ask for what's called an en banc hearing. I don't remember how many judges there are in the whole Ninth Circuit,
uh-huh,
but it's a much larger number. It might be 20 judges.
Wow. The
different circuits have different numbers of judges depending upon the amount of work that they have. And then that entire panel might, if it agrees, the judges themselves take a vote about whether the case will be heard by the panel. And if it goes to the panel, then they would make the decision.
I see. So, and if the whole panel en banc decides one way or the other, if they decide for the lower court judge who ruled against the president, then that ruling would stand because if it's a 4-4 decision, it goes to the last court.
That's right.
Right. Okay. So we don't know really what's going to happen. What do you make of this case?
Well, first of all, I have to say I felt like I had a personal stake because good friends of ours had reunited with their family this morning.
No.
So I feel very relieved, and I'm not sure there was ever a moment when I was thinking of it, you know, just sort of neutrally, what is the law?
So what were your friends like? Can you give us a little bit, without naming names, can you tell us that were they Iranian? What was the
They're Iranian, and our friends are award-winning doctors.
Right. And so they're award-winning doctors, and they were kept out under this.
No. It was their father and brother who were kept out.
Oh, kept out, right. Okay. So so what do you think is bound to happen here? Do you have any sense of it?
Well, I would.
Because, you know, there are people, Steve, who believe that the president is right in this, even though many of us don't like it, that he has the power to do it, and he did it.
Well, policy-wise, I think it's very foolish. I've no question about it, and I think I've talked about these problems in my commentary repeatedly.
Yes, you have.
With respect to what's likely to happen, the administrator, if the Ninth Circuit goes the way we expect and overturns it or sustains the lower court judge, then the administration can either try to tweak the order to eliminate some of the objections, or it could go straight to an appeal. That, to some extent, is a political judgment on what they want to get out of what's happening. I would expect eventually they'll get something, whether they'll get it from the Supreme Court or they'll get it by rewriting some of the provisions. I'm not sure which.
You're talking about the administration now.
Yes, uh-huh. Exactly. Okay. So I think to some extent what the opposition got out of this is partly some public education, partly forcing them possibly to reconsider and rewrite pieces of it. But ultimately, they will probably the administration will probably be able to at least reduce the flow of people very considerably.
Okay, 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Merle on line number one. All right, Merle, you're on.
Hi.
Hi, Merle.
My question, I've got a quick statement, and I live in Argyle, which is in Washington County, New York, and I would like to have, just to let you know, I've been trying to get your book from the library, and they don't have it.
Well, Steve,
on the Rogers Court.
On the Roberts Court? Uh-huh.
Which library?
Yeah, if you could tell your publishers, give the Southern Adirondack Library System a few copies of your book. I'd love to read it.
Okay. Go ahead.
All right, my question is,
and thank you,
to nominate a Supreme Court judge now in the Senate, it takes 62 just to say okay to vote for his confirmation.
That's the current rule. That is the current rule. It's a Senate rule. Basically, the Constitution says each house decides its own rules. And so that's not provided anywhere in statute or in the Constitution what the vote needs to be. I mean, there are arguments one can make about it, but that's been the way it's been handled for 225 years.
But it's about to change. Whoa, bro.
Okay.
It can change, and it can change very easily. If the Senate Republicans now decide to invoke the nuclear option, which they did, because of the Democrats wanted it, for the lower court federal judges. So, in other words, they could change it so it does get to be a simple majority.
It's possible. And for many years, it was argued that the Senate could not change those rules midterm.
Right.
But that seems to have been abandoned.
Flown by the boards.
Yeah.
Okay. So go ahead, Marla.
All right. So the question is, if it goes 60 votes to confirm, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Can one senator still filibuster the 60-vote rule?
No. Essentially, the 60 votes would shut that senator up.
It's called cloture.
Yeah.
Vote cloture. Right.
Oh, okay. So that doesn't count. But all right. So when would the nuclear option come into effect?
As soon as Schumer says
we are going to not give you 60 votes, then Republicans can turn around and say we're going to go nuclear?
Well, they'd have to pass the rules change. And
before confirmation.
They'd have to pass the rules change, and then it wouldn't be 60 votes, and then they would be able to get a majority and confirm Gorsuch, yes.
Hey, Merle, got to let you go. Thank you very much for calling.
Thank you.
Bye. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll be right back. We got to take a short break. We'll talk to Scott next. Okay.
Support for WMT comes from the Henyon Bakery, Amherst, since 1993, offering hearth-baked whole grain breads, pastries, birthday, wedding, and special occasion cakes, as well as gluten-free offerings. HenyonBakery.com. Vermont Coffee Company, offering slow-roasted organic coffee in the brown paper bag at local grocery stores. Vermont Coffee Company, coffee roasted for friends. Shannon Rose Design, Saratoga Springs, New York, working to help companies and organizations express their identities through corporate branding, web design and development, and graphic design for almost three decades. ShannonRose.com. Amherst Copy and Design Works, offering printing and copying, sign making and design services, from booklets to stationery and labels to lawn signs in downtown Amherst, Massachusetts. AmherstCopy.com. And New England Hydroponics, the indoor gardening experts, offering a full selection of hydroponics, organic soils, and indoor gardening equipment, Southampton and Framingham, Massachusetts, online at nehydro.com.
Thank you, Zachary. And we'll go to Scott as promised. Scott, you're on with the professor.
Oh, thanks, Alan. I appreciate what you and the station do every single day. My question is, as Washington State and I believe Minnesota brought this case forward on the immigration ban, is there any impact in the discussion about states' rights versus federal statute? And I can take my question off the air.
No. Stay there. We may want to talk to you.
I don't think legitimately. Here's what I think this case is about. A lot of people keep talking about the president's power as if it's somehow constitutional. But the power over immigration is in the Constitution in Article 1, Section 8, which is the powers of Congress. So there are statutory rules that the president has to conform to rather than constitutional rules. And states' rights don't really play a part there. This is a national decision. It's really up to Congress to set the rules, and then the president is given the power to apply those rules.
That sounds like the way it was constructed a long time ago. I just hope we continue to execute that way.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it, Scott.
Thanks so much.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Okay. We're arranging for strategic important things here. 1-800-348-2551. And now we're going to go to... Did something happen here?
Maybe. We're arranging for strategic important things here. 1-800-348-2555.
Something very strange is happening. We're getting a lot of feedback right here. We're not sure what that is. Okay. All right. All right. Well, we didn't know what it was, but we're going now to go to Emily in New Marlborough. Hi, neighbor. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Thank you. There's a lot of feedback on the line.
We know. We're hearing it also.
Okay, thank you. So congratulations. Congratulations on the fun drive. What I wanted to ask is, I wanted to know if there's something that can be put in place, either a rule or law, where in the future neither party could again duplicate what the Republicans did in dissing Merrick Garland.
Okay, we don't know. Emily, we're working on this. We have our chief cracked engineer right here working on this.
Yeah, it's a fascinating show here, which I don't understand any of.
You never know what you're going to get. You never know what you're going
to
get.
So your question was, is there anything that can be done because of what happened to Merrick Garland? And really, no. The Senate would not now pick up that nomination and confirm him. And the nomination that's on the floor is Neil Gorsuch. And the only thing that's the only ball game in town, so to speak, is that the Democrats will fight it by speaking to the public, speaking on the floor of the Senate, trying to create a record that would be sufficient to convince people to vote against him. That strikes me as unlikely, but that's really the only ball game that there is.
Okay. Thank you very much for that, Emily. Okay, we're working on all of our various issues right here. The whole crew is here, three or four or five people, everybody taking everything's copus mentis now, right? Copus mentis, okay. All right, so we knocked somebody off. So if you were on, call that 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, and we'll put you right back on, okay. And so, Steve, I guess there's a lot of confusion here because people don't really understand a lot about the court, right? Now, you wrote a wonderful book about Justice Roberts and the court, and Roberts, of course, is now one of four. If, in fact, Gorsuch gets back on the court, he's going to have a great deal to say, Roberts will, with what goes on. Perhaps you could explain very quickly how it is determined who writes the decisions.
Well, first of all, of course, there are eight justices right now.
Right.
There have been a variety of different numbers of justices since 1789 when the first justices were appointed. There's nothing magical about the number of nine except that that's what Congress, I believe, has designated.
Yeah.
So right now there are eight because we're trying to fill the ninth seat. If the Chief Justice is in the majority when they take their straw poll in the conference. Then the Chief Justice gets to assign the opinion to whoever he thinks should write that opinion. To some extent, he's trying to even out the load because opinion writing is a fair amount of work, and so he's trying to give similar numbers of opinions to all of the justices, but of course he's constrained by who supports the result. And then there's a question of, is somebody necessary to hold that majority together? Or can he use somebody to stake out a very strong position? So often Justice Kennedy will be the justice that writes some of the most difficult decisions because his vote is necessary to the majority.
Interesting.
And if you give it to Justice Kennedy, he's going to write an opinion and he can sign. Whereas if you give it to somebody else, they may turn Kennedy off. So he's been the swing justice, and that matters a great deal. The Chief Justice will often take some of the most important decisions for himself, but again, that depends on those other factors. If Gorsuch is appointed, that may still leave Kennedy as the swing justice, because although we talk about a 4-4 court, it can be 4-3-1. With Kennedy still crucial about whether they will tie or whether there will be a 5-3 vote. Most of Kennedy's decisions are quite conservative, but there are fairly predictable areas like the gay rights area where Kennedy has been regularly siding with the liberal justices.
Now, just in case, I think you mentioned that, just in case the Roberts side does not prevail as the chief, then the senior judge on the other side gets to assign the decision. Is that right?
That's right. And, we hear that Justice Ginsburg is enjoying that role in the few cases where she gets it. Justice Stevens got that role fairly often.
Yeah. Now, Justice Scalia, the late Justice Scalia, was a good friend of Justice Ginsburg. How did that work out? They played poker together. They liked each other.
And they sang together on the stage of the Metropolitan Opera in New York. They're opera lovers. Some people may realize that in the summer, Justice Ginsburg has been coming to Glimmerglass, to the Glimmerglass Opera, and giving a lecture from the opera stage. I haven't been able to get there on those times. I've wanted to.
How old is she? Do you know? Do you remember?
Well, she was born, I believe, in 1933, which would make her 83 or 4 now.
Okay, we're going to go now to Doug in New Marlborough. All right, Doug, it's your turn. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just have a quick point of clarification from something you gentlemen were talking about earlier, and then I have a follow-up question.
Why do people assume our answers are going to be quick?
Because it's a math question.
Okay.
Does it take 60 votes to change the rule in the Senate, or can that be done with just the 51 majority?
That's a very interesting question. My understanding or my assumption based on the conversation is it doesn't take 60. Well, couldn't they filibuster that rule change? And the discussion seems to suggest, I haven't personally looked up those Senate rules to see how it's done, but the discussion seems to assume that it can be done by the Republicans, and they don't have anything close to 60 votes.
No, it would have to be a majority vote. That's the way they would do it. Good question, Doug, but I think that's the answer.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
If we're wrong, we'll find out about it fast enough. Go ahead.
And was my answer quick?
Yeah. Yes, very quick. it's just I seem to have remembered that when the Democrats wanted to change the rules on the other federal judgeships, they had to recruit Republicans to agree, but you may be right. It may be a simple majority. The follow-up is that as a Democrat, and of course being upset about not allowing President Obama to have his pick voted on, with Gorsuch, do Democrats want to consider not fighting on this one, especially to maintain a 62 vote need, and rather pick their fight on the next one that may replace someone? I mean, she should live to 120, but someone like Justice Ginsburg or another judge who passes or retires during this Trump administration.
Of course, what you're asking is a strategic question rather than a legal question. But my sense is that when you show power, you have power, because it's to some extent a self-fulfilling prophecy. And if you show weakness, then you are weak because everybody treats you like you're weak. So I'm not sure that the Democrats have the choice that you're thinking of unless there's some behind-the-scenes bargain. That's a different kind of a question, that they could bargain for it, but I don't think they can make a unilateral decision to back off this one.
Okay.
You know, Doug, I was just talking to one of our experts down in Washington, David Hawkins, the head of Roll Call magazine and a major editor on CQ. He posited exactly what you've just said. And I suspect that Schumer and his group are going to have to make a decision on their own. They're not going to be able to sit down and say, okay, here's the deal. And if you go along, they're not going to go along. And so they have to strategically decide whether to let Gorsuch in and to reestablish sort of the court as it was under Scalia.
And that raises a question for me about the position of Elizabeth Warren, because what people are expecting from Elizabeth Warren is the tiger senator.
Right.
And when she backed off on, I forget who it was, a couple of days ago.
Human Services, yeah.
When she backed off on
housing,
that,
it was Carson. Carson, right.
A lot of people got very upset with her. Now, I can understand what may have been in her mind, but she's a fairly new politician. And I don't think she feels the dynamics quite the same way that somebody like Sanders or Schumer does, who have been there for quite a while. I think on substantive grounds, she's wonderful. I would have been delighted to have her as president. But in terms of her handling of the strategy, I think she made a mistake there. Just strategically. Again, I'm not addressing the question of whether Carson was fit for the job or whatever.
Doug, I'm going to let you go. Thank you very much for your call. Appreciate it. Okay. Now we're going to go to Mark in Cohoes. Okay, Mark in Cohoes, you're on.
Hello, Alan. Thank you for everything you've done. I have a simple question. Is there any way that in the future that we can ever see the popular vote be more pertinent, either within or without the Electoral College?
The answer is, of course, yes. And there are at least two paths to that. One is, I believe there are now 20 states that have signed an agreement that if there are enough states signing the agreement that they would have the majority of the Electoral College, then they would collectively swing their delegates to the winner of the popular vote. But if we don't get enough electoral votes within that coalition of states, or if it happens that some of the states don't trust the others and the coalition breaks down, then the other alternative is a constitutional amendment. Whether that would pass or not, I don't know, because it takes a lot more than a majority of the American people.
So my question to you, Mark, is I'm going to assume for a second, probably is not a good assumption, that you are, still mourning the loss for Hillary.
Good assumption.
Yeah. Would you, and let's assume that the shoe were on the other foot, right? And that Hillary won the electoral vote but not the popular vote. Would you be talking the same way?
Probably not, Alan, but in view of what happened the last time with the Democrats having the popular vote yet losing the presidency, I would have hoped that they would have thought about changing things when Obama had the opportunity.
Well,
I don't think it's going to happen.
Well, you're right,
in
Mark.
The next 4 years.
But I don't think Obama was making those decisions. I think that had to be, something that was coming from the Congress itself. And I doubt very much that you were going to find that. But I think, it's just fascinating to play what if. I think Steve's point here is very well taken about this agreement among the states, how we're going to handle it from now on. But can you imagine if it was now very close to decision time, and it looked like your candidate was going to lose, whether the state legislature in that particular state, one state legislature or two, would rescind their understanding of what they had agreed to? As you said, Steve, can we really trust them? probably not.
I don't know. So actually, the question about the impact of the electoral vote system is probably more complicated than the discussion seems to reflect, because campaigning would be different. Well,
Trump claims that that's what happened this time, that he was after the electoral vote. He wasn't after the popular vote.
Well, I mean, you could run a campaign strategy that way, certainly. And probably most people do to some extent look at it. But beyond that, when something happens like it did in Florida in 2000, in a way, we could say this is Florida. And it had a big impact, of course, on the country. But if it's just a popular vote, it means we really have to recount the country. The New York Times did some studies on that Florida vote, and it found that if they had just recounted the counties that Gore asked for, he would have lost. He had already gotten those votes.
Wouldn't have mattered.
But if they had recounted, as they were in the process of doing, the whole state, then Gore would have won.
Yeah, you said the country. You meant the state.
No, I didn't mean the state. I mean, if you eliminated the Electoral College, then the recount that would be comparable to that statewide recount would be a national recount. So there'd be all sorts of things that would be different in that situation. On the other hand, the Electoral College is a vestige of slavery. I mean, that's why it's there. Because without it, you couldn't have a popular vote. The slave owners couldn't get to count, have their slaves counted. And so ideologically, the Electoral College feels ever more wrong to me.
Mark, got to let you go and take a break. Thank you for calling.
Thank
Very
you
good
so
question.
Much.
Yeah. Okay, Zachary, take it away.
Support for WAMC comes from Coldham and Hartman Architects, serving residential and institutional clients with architecture designed for resilience and renewability. Designed for the next 100 years, CandHArchitects.com. College Street Motors, Amherst, Massachusetts, for over 30 years specializing in foreign and domestic car and truck repair and 24-hour towing, full-service gas includes checking of fluids, tire pressure, and window washing. CollegeStreetMotors.com. Curtis Lumber, providing home improvement products and advice to homeowners and contractors, supporting local communities for over a century. CurtisLumber.com. The Tang Teaching Museum and Art Gallery at Skidmore College, providing exhibits, public events, and educational programs for audiences in the Capital District and beyond. Skidmore.edu/Tang. And Clipcentric Albany, a local video services division of Clipcentric, producing video advertisements for businesses throughout the capital region for web, mobile, and TV. Albany.clipcentric.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are back. With Professor Steve Gottlieb, and the reason that we have to go fast now is we have a lot of people on the phone. We want to give everybody ample time and justice, but the truth of the matter is we got to move. So
we want to give them more justice than they get from the courts.
Yes, that's a good point. So let's keep it short. We're now going to Peter in Albany. Peter in Albany, you're on, Peter.
Hi. First, let me say... I'm an ESL teacher. I've worked with refugees. I'm very much against this seven-nation travel ban. But having said that, my question is, the reaction by New York State to declare our to propose to declare our state a sanctuary state, that strikes me as very unconstitutional. Isn't immigration controlled by the federal government? I mean, a year ago, all the right-wing types were like, call your governor, tell him no Syrian refugees. And that would be unconstitutional.
Before you speak, Steve, I wanted to just make at least the latest update that I had was the Assembly is for it, but not the Senate.
Thanks to gerrymandering.
But can it possibly
be legal?
What'd you say? Okay, now to the legality.
Even if it's a good idea, could it possibly be legal?
Well, it depends on what the state is talking about actually doing when it says a sanctuary. Because there have been a number of decisions of the U.S. Supreme Court that say that the federal government cannot commandeer state officials to do a federal job. So what is it that the state is refusing to do that they have to do by some valid federal law? It's not clear that the state is refusing to do something that it has to do.
I think it's a very good answer, Steve. Your answer is very good. In other words, you could say, okay, we're a sanctuary state. What does that mean? I don't know. You know,
right.
It could mean anything. But if there's specifics that attached to it, which say, if you do this, then you can't arrest anybody or something, that might get you into trouble.
Well, you know, if you blocked a federal official from making an arrest,
right.
you would certainly be violating federal law. But if you're just saying, well, we're not going to make the arrest for you, I don't think the state has to.
Yeah. It's interesting because haven't there been cases like that where there's a federal narcotics issue in which they say, you know, legalizing marijuana is against the law and the federal law. And the state says, no, we're doing it. And the feds have backed off on something like
and
that.
I was fascinated when that case came up to the United States Supreme Court because you get all of the states' rights people on the conservative side, but they're also very anti-drug people on the conservative side, and they actually split in that decision. And it was Justice Thomas who said, why aren't you, my fellow conservatives, noticing that there's a states' rights issue here?
He said it out loud?
Oh, he wrote it.
Oh, that's great. Okay, Peter, thank you very much. All right. That's a joke, you see, because he doesn't talk very much. You know,
right.
That's the whole point. Okay, and now we're going to Kathy in Liberty. Kathy in Liberty, you're on. Go.
Hi. I have a question about the advice and consent process. And I know this is a little like water under the bridge, but when Obama was still president and he nominated Garland and this the Senate refused to have any hearings at all. I read somewhere that if the Senate let go of its responsibility to give advice, that the president could, there would be a waiting period that he could wait for them to act on his nomination, and if they didn't act on it, he could unilaterally appoint a justice. But of course, that never happened, obviously. And I had always wondered: is that true? Is that would that have been a pathway?
I don't think so. Basically, the president has the power to make what are called recess appointments, and the Senate was very careful that there was no recess. So that the president can do that. But
have done it as a recess appointment.
And then it would end when the next Senate came and met. So it would be for a very limited time period.
Mm.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Okay, let's go to Ed in Saugerties. Ed in Saugerties, you're on now.
Hello.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, okay, good. My question is, in the legal proceedings that are going on, as I understand, the government is claiming the president is claiming national security interests. And I'm just wondering, is there any factual burden on him? Because as far as I'm aware, there is not a shred of evidence to support the naming of the specific countries that he has named in the ban, and the omission of Saudi Arabia as the prime example of a country that has well-known links to terrorist networks going back to 9/11. And also, the second part of that is, does the fact that he has business interests in Saudi Arabia, Indonesia, and other countries that have known links to terrorism raise a conflict of interest question?
Of course it raises a conflict of interest question, but whether that's relevant to the statute that we're talking about. If this case were being decided in the Ninth Circuit on constitutional grounds, then the question that you raise about where do the terrorists actually come from would seem to me to be very relevant and would be very much part of the argument that the lawyers would be making. On the other hand, to the extent that this is actually a statutory question, or at least I believe that's what's happening, I have not actually read the briefs in that case. Of course, they were filed. Some of them were filed today and last night, and so forth. To the extent that I'm correct, that this is actually a statutory rather than a constitutional case, I'm not sure that would be relevant at all. It would be a question of what the terms of the statute are.
Well, but maybe I'm missing something. But doesn't there have to be a rational relationship between a stated objective and the policy, whether it's statutory or constitutional?
It depends on the language. If the language says that the president can only do something that's reasonable, then you're absolutely right. But if the language simply says the president gets to decide who comes in, then it won't be considered at all.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. And now we're going to go, waiting for a while now, is Sue in Rochester. Sue, are you really up there in Rochester?
Yes. How are you?
Good.
Congratulations.
Well, thank you, dear. Are you listening on the web, or are you
yes,
getting another?
Yes,
okay, great.
Yes. I listen to every talk show you have. That's the only place I get any relief.
Great. Go ahead.
I have a question. It seems to me that there's been a lot. There is a lot of pushback that I'm starting to see, notwithstanding the Women's March and the pushback on the this immigration executive order. But it seems to me that the Democrats will gain some power when it comes time to start passing laws to replace, for instance, statutes of the Affordable Care Act or the Dodd-Frank. When they need 60 votes, they're going to look to the Democrats to help them pass some of these laws. And it seems to me then that the Democrats will start to fall into, start to gain some power at that point. Is that correct?
Well, it depends on whether the cloture rule applies or whether the Republicans eliminate the cloture rule so that 50 votes or 51 votes are enough to a simple majority is enough to move the discussion. So
it's not just the court. It's no. Also lawmaking.
Well, the Senate has had a general filibuster rule for quite a long time. That is a rule that as many senators that want to speak, they're entitled to speak, and for as long as they want to. Very, very different from the rules in the House of Representatives. I think you're correct that that still applies to ordinary legislation.
Yeah.
I'm not positive of that. I don't know the extent of the change that was made when the Democrats were in control. What? It's close to 8 years ago.
Right.
So I'm not sure whether the cloture rule is still applicable to ordinary legislation or it was just abrogated with respect to lower court judges.
Judges, yeah. What if Gorsuch does not achieve 60 votes? Say he gets 58 votes.
And the cloture rule, which is on the Senate rules now, applies. Then that means that he doesn't actually come up from for an up or down vote, because the cloture issue would be to close down the conversation.
Right. But in the up or down vote, he still needs 60 votes.
Under the present,
go ahead, Alan.
I may be wrong about this, but under the present rule, the lower courts, they did away with the cloture rule.
Right.
Yeah.
The Supreme Court is still the 60 votes.
But I think it's 60 votes to close debate, not that you have to get 60 votes to win.
Oh, I see.
Right.
I think.
Then
so
it's
there are
majority?
There are two separate votes, and the second vote is a majority vote. But you have
to
get the 60 votes in order to get to the majority vote.
To the vote. Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay. And now we go to, hanging on for a long time, is Lauren in Troy. Okay, Lauren, you're on.
Yes. Good afternoon. Professor Gottlieb, I wanted to get your reaction and perhaps that of your colleagues you've spoken with or read anything from about Trump's recent statements, which seem to want to undermine confidence in the judiciary. He's gone after the press, we know, and then right after appointing a Supreme Court candidate, calls the judge a so-called judge and says, blame any terrorism on our court system.
Mm-hmm.
That, to me, was shocking.
I would react, and I did react in exactly the same way. It doesn't have any particular legal consequence, except to the extent that people are offended by his doing that, and then the way that it plays out into the politics. He is, of course, not the first president who has taken pot shots at a judge whose decisions he did not like. I can remember in the years that I was in law school and a new lawyer, all around where I traveled, seeing these signs that said impeach Warren. And I must say I was very offended by it.
And by the way, Ike is reported to have said, worst decision he ever made in appointing Warren.
That may be. A friend of mine locally has done a study of the work of Herbert Brownell, essentially to create, through Eisenhower, the federal court system, Brownell was his attorney general, to create the federal system that really enforced desegregation. And a lot to do with a number of the Supreme Court decisions. So I'm not sure what Eisenhower actually said, but it, lots of people have taken potshots at judges for doing things that they don't like.
But to insinuate that, you know, people should blame the court system, that was just...
Well, wait a second now. Wait a second. This is the same man who said that the election, the real disgrace, was going to be rigged. The election he won, and undermining the whole peaceful transfer of power and the whole idea of the way in which we have always done business in this country is degenerate. I mean, that was crazy.
So what you're saying is that these comments were very much in keeping for Trump, not that they in any sense excuse his behavior. It's just he's delegitimizing everything that doesn't agree with him. And yes, there's a real problem in a democracy when we can't accept the legitimacy of the decisions, don't have to agree with them, but the legitimacy of decisions that are made either by the voters or by other departments or institutions and so forth. The democracy depends on the notion that we find ways to live together and respect each other.
I've always been scared, Steve, about the idea that if he said this election was going to be rigged, what if in 3 years or 4 years he says the next election is going to be rigged? But now he's president of the United States and has four or five generals in his cabinet.
Well, some of us think...
And how can you trust anything that goes to a court for a decision if the president himself will say, well, you know, the court system, you can't really trust it.
That's what terrifies me about the Gorsuch nomination. But I would say that this, in certain respects, this election was rigged, and it was actually rigged in the favor of the Republicans. And what I'm really thinking about most strongly, although there are other things as well, are the decisions that allowed the Republicans to proceed with gerrymanders around the country, which has taken control or given control not to the people over the House of Representatives, but to their colleagues to decide, well, does so-and-so live or die in the House or the state legislature or wherever? Yeah. That is rigging of the elections, and there are various other things that were done. My fear is that if or when Gorsuch gets confirmed by the Senate, we have a Supreme Court which, for another generation, will not do anything constructive with respect to that issue.
Okay, Lauren, going to have to let you go. Thank you for the call.
Thank you.
We've got a Mark now. And, Mark, you got a couple of minutes here, but that's it. Go ahead.
Yes, I have a question for the professor. I was hoping you could expound upon his statement concerning that the Electoral College is kind of a holdover from slavery, and that was the main reason it was implemented. Because that doesn't really coincide with the Federalist Papers, which, just interestingly enough, Hamilton wrote to the people of the state of New York when he first published that. It seems to me like the Electoral College, New York is a great example, especially when it comes to things like the SAFE Act, where the majority of the state is opposed county-wise and population-wise, but that SAFE Act is still enforced basically on the desires and wishes of a few counties, primarily New York City and maybe one or two near Buffalo, the high urban population centers.
Remember that the Federalist Papers were propaganda. That's why they were written. They were not written in any sense as a dispassionate review of whether the Constitution should be adopted. They were written all in praise. And what actually happened in the convention, the notes of which were secret for another 50 years after that, because they only came out after James Madison died, and we don't have a transcript. I mean, Madison's notes were notes, not the actual transcript.
In fact, it was forbidden, and he broke the law. And
he was trying to provide some income for his widow Dolly when he died, but what his notes reveal is very clearly, we could not have popular election because for the South it meant that they would lose. We would not have had, maybe we've had Washington, but you would not have had Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, and a whole succession of Southern presidents if we had not had an electoral college.
Okay, got to let you go. We are out of time. Thanks, everybody who called in. I want to thank Professor Steve Gottlieb for joining us today. Support for the Vox Pop comes from Gazebo, Northampton, Massachusetts, an independent lingerie shop specializing in bra and post-mastectomy fittings, providing support to the Pioneer Valley for almost 40 years. The-gazebo.com. Windy Hollow Veterinary Clinic, Montague, Massachusetts, conventional and integrative veterinary medicine, including acupuncture, comprehensive pet care, and health services since 1998. WindyHollowVet.com. Thanks again for joining us. Our engineer has been Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered by Suzanne Chekai. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Alan Chartok. Stay tuned now for a news update.